kind of nails my modus operandi, my way of operating, which is escape. And I remember when I was here along one of the first sesshins I went to was here, and I went to Mike for Dokusan, I think, and I said, this is hard. The first one was easy because it was so exciting and new and novel, and I was younger. And the second one was also exciting, but the third one is hard. You know, it wasn't very. And he looked at me, and I've told the story before, and he said, "What should we do? Run away?" I don't think it was rhetorical either. I think it was. I felt like we could have made off right then and maybe gone down to a driving range or something and escaped from just sitting here and facing off every day for 7 days. Anyway, in a way, my theme today is escape, I'm thinking that when, to do a little comparison with, you know, even the Buddha escaped at one point. You know, he left his wife and child behind to do what he did. And I'm always considering the difference between escape and liberation. And in my case, it's been, I think, mostly liberation, or mostly escape. I just liked it. But this last spring, I was living in Half Moon Bay, and a couple of years before, I had been laid off as a high school teacher, and I was still holding that resentment against the principal that fired me, the new principal. And I'd been teaching in the district for a couple of years, but still didn't have tenure because I was new. And I was drinking, and my wife was getting pretty fed up with it. And at one point she said, "I can't, this isn't what I signed up for. Why don't you leave?" You know. And I said, "Well, I can't leave. I don't have any money. I can't go anywhere. And I don't want to. I like it here." And I said, "What do I have to do to stay?" And she said, "Well, you have to get a sponsor, and you have to start going to AA meetings." And I said, "Okay, but in the meantime, I was plotting my escape." And so I started going to meetings, and I got a sponsor, and I applied to Tassajara on the summer program, the work apprentice, which isn't quite as arduous as the regular practice periods, and it's warmer. And they put me on a waiting list, and then they called me up one weekend and said, "You're in, if you want to come." And I said, "Great." And then I thought about it. You go to Tassajara from April 26 to September, or April 6 to September 26, and that's almost 6 months. I could never do that. I mean, that would disrupt my life. So I called them back, or I emailed them, and this is all done by email, and said, "No, I can't come, really. Health insurance problems." And then... I talked to my yoga teacher, who said, "You should go." I talked to my sponsor, who said, "You should make lists of pros and cons, and you shouldn't go." And my wife said, "Well, that's another exotic escape." And not entirely unsympathetically, but you know, that's what it seemed like to her. And so on the very last day before I was scheduled to go, well, I wrote an email back, said, "Will you still take me?" And they said, "Yeah, you're lucky. We didn't sign, there was a waiting list, but we didn't get around to it, so you can still come." So I said, "All right, I'll be there." And I told my wife the day before I left that I was going. The theme for my talk today is what I did this summer for my vacation. And Mike actually suggested that I talk a little bit about my experience at Tassajara. A little background on Tassajara for me was that I used to go there when I was 10 years old, which was 50 years ago. And my family used to go to Tassajara on vacation before it was a Zen monastery, when they still served corned beef and cabbage and wine, and they had a bar, and I wasn't drinking then, I was only 10. But I really enjoyed the swimming pool and the big inner tubes and the smell of sulfur. And even then, it was a very peaceful place. And also, I associated it with my family going to a fun place with friends and having fun. And there was something exotic about it then. I remember this little pool of water in the rock that looked just ice cold, refreshing. And you'd scoop it out, and it was almost 200 degrees. I've always liked that. And the baths at that time were just plaster shedding paint and really funky, steamy things. And Tassajara is at the end of a 14-mile dirt road up and down, and brakes burn out, and it's a hard place to get to. And I've always wanted to go there. And when I was in high school, my girlfriend and I told her mother and my mother that we were going to meet some people and go up to Berkeley for a while. And we just crossed the road and hitchhiked from Monterey to Tassajara. And we spent the night at China Peak, and then we went into Tassajara. So, and then we had a lot of fun, and it was kind of an exotic, illegitimate pleasure. And then later on, I went back there with my partner and spent a week there as a guest. And then, after it was a Zen monastery. And then I started going to San Francisco Zen Center. And I really wound up here and in terms of my Zen training, and this place was founded by Koban, who helped found Tassajara, really. Another note of interest to me, probably not to you, is that my sister's fifth grade teacher, Mr. Beck, owned Tassajara before the Zen people did. And my sister played Lady Macbeth in a play that she put on in fourth grade with Mr. Beck, and we had an alligator in our bathtub all year long, thanks to Mr. Beck. And it was a fourth grade, fifth grade project for her. Alligator. She raised an alligator, and then when we were done with the school project, she gave it back to the pet store instead of putting it in a sewer. But Mr. Beck was a character, and Tassajara was a special place. And finally, I was going to go there. And so I got in my car early one morning, and they said, be here by 8:30 at Jamesburg, and you'll meet the shuttle and go in. And I got there at 8:30, and he said, there won't be a shuttle for several hours. You can go in, you can drive in if you want. And I was getting anxious. I wanted to get there. And so I went around the road closed sign and, you know, flood damage. And he said, sure, go ahead. You know, it's open, really. But there were all these signs that said road closed. And this is in April, and I got to the top of the hill, and there was snow on the ground, and I was shocked. I grew up in Monterey and used to go to Carmel in the summers, Carmel Valley in the summers. And snow is not something you see in Carmel Valley. But there it was. And drove down the hill, and first day, other people started arriving about 1. I'd been there at 9, and there was the sulfur smell. And it's Tassajara. Steinbeck says Tassajara means cup and saucer, and I don't see why that would apply. There's nothing that suggests cup and saucer. And then other people say that it's a degradation or a derivation from where meat is dried, or dried meat, because the Native Americans used to dry meat, and the hunters used to go there to dry their meat, because I don't know why. Maybe they used the hot springs in some way. But it's always been kind of a hunting center. So Tassajara, and where Hara would be kind of related to the word jerky or something like that. It sounds bogus to me, but that's what I read. And I just love the name Tassajara. It sounds magical. So because I was driving my own car, and because I'm addicted to many things besides alcohol, including books, I took like 4 or 5 boxes of books. I realized it was supposed to be an arduous emotional and physical experience. You sit, and the schedule goes like, it's not as arduous as the practice period, but you still wake up at 5:15, and you sit for an hour, and then you sit for another hour, and you have breakfast, and then you work all day, and if you're off, you have a service at noon, and then you have a service at 5, and then you sit in the evening for an hour, and you have the refuges about 9 or so, and then you're up again the next morning, but I took a lot of books, thinking I would have a lot of time to read, and I love the idea of books. That it's the same thing that alcohol presents, really. It's that infinite potential. I took books on how to draw, how to write poetry, how to meditate, how to cook. I mean, you could be anything in this wonderful delusional world of books, It looked silly once I got there, but I was really the only one who saw my room with my complete library. And there's already a complete library there, a beautiful little library. I'm thinking, this is what I did this summer, but I'm thinking of all the summers in my early childhood, about the time I was going to Tassajara. And I remember, I don't know if any of you did this, but where you get involved with the library reading program for kids. And I remember, you'd read books, and then you'd go to the librarian and report back to her. And then I remember one particular summer where the theme was going to the moon, and for each book, you'd go a little bit closer with your rocket. And, finally, after, I don't remember how many books, maybe 20, you'd get to the moon. And then, so one summer I went to the moon with my books, and this summer I went to Tassajara. And there are similarities, and one of them is the thread of lost childhood, I think. Because going to Tassajara, I go down Carmel 1, I go into the Carmel Valley, where my mother used to take us swimming. Monterey never unfogged during the summer. We'd have to go to Carmel Valley and we'd swim in the community pool there. So it has another childhood association. And then my father, when my parents divorced, he moved to the village. And so as I went to Tassajara, I passed where he had lived and where he died, and where his ashes were scattered into Carmel River. So it had a little bit of nostalgia for me, childhood and parents and alike. So I arrived on April 26th in a strange situation, exotic situation, and I was standing in line for lunch, and this guy said, "You're Steve." And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Remember me? I'm Alan, the bee man, Alan Hawkins." And I had taken some classes with my wife at Green Gulch on beekeeping, 2 or 3 classes. So, and he remembered me. I didn't remember him really. He said, I'm here to set up some bee stuff for Graham, who was the tenso and lived with the head of Tassajara Mako. And he said, "You be my assistant today. You're a bee man." And so that was a thrill for me, actually. I didn't have to clean cabins that first day. So I went off with Alan Hawkins and helped with the boss's bees, and they're thinking of getting some bees in there and setting them up in the garden, and they're doing a thorough Zen mindful job where they spend days and days building the platform for the bee hive and so forth. But that was a lot of fun. We took apart the beehives and looked at them and saw the brood and didn't actually see the queen, but there were eggs that indicated that she'd been around, and it was all very exciting, and I felt very special getting to be with the bee man, and thought a little bit about why bees are such a good model for Buddhists in a way. They're community organ, they stick together, the Sangha, and they're doing something productive. They're always busy, they're our model for busyness, and they move together in very strange ways. You know, they decide who the queen is going to be, and they feed that egg until it's a queen, and the queen actually develops a little faster than the rest of the bees, but gets bigger and can do 10,000 eggs a day when she's rocking. And so I'm thinking also, you know, Zen is the study of self, and then to study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to actualize 10,000 things, the way I read it once, a myriad things. But when you get a new bee, when you get a new queen with a box, you usually get 10,000 bees. I think that's nice, that you dump in the new hive 10,000 things. So obviously bees are directly related to Buddhism. And they communicate through dance. I like that too. The question arises, of course, do bees have Buddha nature? And we'll get back to that. So I went there part to Tassajara, part to relive some childhood stuff, and partly for Zen training, and partly for rehab, because it's 14 miles down a dirt road, you're not going to drink a lot. But summer is Zen, is the guest season, so actually there is a lot of drinking there. And the first day I got there, after the bee man, I was sitting around dinner, and you all eat outside because it's a work week, and this woman says, you know, you guys want to come up to my room for some beer? I always bring beer for these work weekends, and nice cold beer. And it's only day one, so I said no, not why I'm here. Because my sponsor said, if you want beer, if you want alcohol, you'll get it. But I did, just dispel the suspense. Now, I didn't drink for 6 months, and it was easy because you're working hard, there's something about Tassajara and being in black robes a lot that makes Guinness Stout seem unnecessary, I guess. So I'd like to just talk a little bit about the people there, and just kind of to make this a Zen talk instead of an AA talk, about some of the people that I came into contact with and some of the things I learned. I'm sure you already know most of this stuff, but it was interesting to be there. The Tanta, the guy who was in charge of the students, was a guy named Greg Fain, and he had been to Japan, I guess, and he learned how to chant in a funny Japanese way, and he wore big black glasses that are the actual, I think they're required wear in some Japanese monasteries because they make you look like a Zen master right away. Do you know anything
black,
about that?
Black rims?
Yeah.
Like old-fashioned Japanese?
Yeah, glasses. like Elvis Costello. Uh-huh.
Do you know him?
I don't think so.
I'm making a lot of this up. he told me, and occasionally, today is the first day I've ever sat on the brown cushion looking out, and Greg was always there watching us and listening for watches going off, and he'd stride up to people with their watches, their alarms going off, and rip their watches.
I should interject. Tanto, in a monastic situation, in Tassajara, Tanto is a leader of practice.
Yes.
So, even when the abbot's not there, like there wasn't a teacher there. Right?
Leslie Dames was there. She was the abiding teacher, but she lives part time at Jamesburg, and so we had Greg kind of in charge, and his wife was also there.
Mm-hmm.
And he's an authoritative figure, and he's kind of fun to be with. And he'd be sitting there maybe in the second hour, and suddenly the voice would boom out, "Open your eyes! Zazen is not an escape!" And I said, "Damn it." And I had a wall between me and Greg, so my eyes were closed a lot. And then in Dokusan, and he was a practice leader also, and I saw all five practice leaders while I was there, thinking diversity, diversity. And Greg taught me, actually, as I was trying to close myself off from disturbing situation and obnoxious people, that your job is to include, don't exclude. That was an important lesson that I learned. And at the same time, he informed me that making boundaries between you and other people is a gift you can give. So it was like, include. Boundaries are a gift you can give. So it was interesting. Because there were people that would just intrude on your space. And it was what they did best, and they loved to do it. And like Greg's advice was, make boundaries. Then Judith Randall was the person I was most closely used as a practice leader. She was a small woman with white fuzz on her cheeks and big teeth, and maybe not surprisingly, she loved being a clown. She actually taught a seminar while I was there with another guy, Moish, on clowning, which you could attend. That was the great thing about Tassajara during the summer, is there are all these seminars, and you can attend as a student. You can do yoga, you can do clowning, you can do drawing, you can do birding. Jane Hirschfield was there, the poet, and I took a couple classes from her. So it was... and I took a clowning class from Judith, and she was also my primary practice leader. Right in the first couple of days I was there, she said, "There's a reason you're here." And she just let it go at that. I said, "Well, that's magical." And she was also the one who explained that, and I said, "It seems to me the people that succeed are the people that can delay gratification, can put things off and not do it right now. Like people that go to medical school, or people that go to law school, or people that do the work now and don't always." And yet the message here is we were always trying to get into the moment, not think about the past, not think about the future, just be in the moment. And she said, "Well, what we're doing here is this delicate dance between the absolute, being in the moment, and your life in the relative world, which you aren't going to escape. So get used to it, that transition back and forth between the absolute and the relative." And then there was Paul, and there was Mako, who was one of the fire nuns, fire priests that helped fight the fire at Tassajara. Mm-hmm. And her advice to me, and what she did by an example in Dokusan, and everywhere, you ask her a question, she'd give you the whole story about how she became interested in Buddhism because her mother made her watch horror films late at night. And I didn't understand, but you had the impression she was telling the whole story, and that her mother had not been able to tell her the truth about things, so damn it, she was going to tell the truth. You ask her a question and you'd get it. And it's a difficult thing to do, and I think in AA they'd say the people that fail at this program are people who are incapable, maybe from birth, of a rigorous honesty. And so Mako is there being rigorously honest all the time, and I appreciated that. And then Paul Holler from San Francisco was there, the abbot, and I went Dokusan with him once, and he just honed right in. I said, you know, I'm here kind of avoiding my wife, I'm kind of avoiding my home situation, and I'm thinking maybe I'll stay here, maybe I'll be here for the practice period. And he said, well, I'd support you in that, but don't make your wife, don't make your marriage, don't make your life outside separate from Zazen, separate from Zen. I said, how do you do that? But it was, I think, important that there's that, you don't do that duality. You work at both at the same time. So I'm there thinking, this is what I'm good at, sitting. You know, not saying much and just sitting and studying the self. And maybe I won't go back and try to get a job teaching in high school, which I hated anyway to some extent. And it was hard on my heart. And so maybe I'll stay here and do practice period. And I was thinking about that and thinking my wife got pretty tired of me. Maybe I should stay here. And there's Green Gulch, there's City Center, there's Jokoji, there's Tassajara, which is where I've always wanted to be. So maybe that's really not an escape. Maybe it's the thing I want to do. In the kitchen, I work all the time. I kind of lobbied for a kitchen job, and they actually gave me a kitchen job. So I actually learned how to make yogurt for 200 people. I learned how to make chocolate chip cookies, 300 at a time. I learned how to make breakfast. I learned how to cook eggs on a huge grill. It was very, very hot, and then clean the grill. I learned that. And so I was working in the kitchen 6 to 8 hours a day and really enjoying it. I also learned how to wash dishes and how to do the big things first. And but mostly I learned about working with people that were obnoxious, like teenagers who were holier than I was and had a lot more energy and yet had little temper tantrums. And I'd get just bent out of shape with these people. And I had been a writer, and I worked for 25 years writing for educational publishing. And so I wasn't used to being around people, even though I taught high school for a couple of years. I was the boss in that case, and I kind of tried to transfer the bossness to the kitchen. And that didn't work with these damn teenagers anyway. And so gradually, actually, the guy I worked for, the guest cook, I was his helper. He actually cooked for the guests. I cooked for the students mostly. And he said, you know, he was actually in AA also. There was an AA meeting there once a week at Tassajara. But it was kind of watered down. It was like there were addicts, there were food addicts, there were love addicts, there were narcotic addicts. And then, you know, it just seemed like there was, in my judgmental mind, I just got thinking that this isn't, these guys really aren't as desperate as I am. I mean, there was a good, solid, alcoholic heroin addict there that she was a priest, and we got along. She was Irish, and she was an editor, but I learned some stuff from her. But my friend, my guest teacher, my guest cook, who said to me when I was particularly bent out of shape by these people I was working with in the kitchen, you know, in AA they say if you meet an asshole, a couple assholes, two assholes before noon, you might consider the fact that you're the asshole. And I said, whoa, I usually meet four before breakfast. And I thought that was probably the one lesson that sunk in, and that I have to be, my tenso said, The tenso is the head of the kitchen. This is Graham, the bee man, one of the guy that was talking about bees, and a student of Paul Holler's, and he's lived at Tassajara for like 8 years, and he's Mako's partner. So they, a couple that really kind of runs the place in a way. And I went to him and said, what do I do? I'm just angry all the time with these people. And he said, well, I'll give you the short course. Do the experiment. be angry, hold the grudge, be judgmental, and see how it makes you feel. Do that for a day, and if you feel more liberated and spacious and good about things, let me know. Now that was rhetorical. And after that, I tried to be more generous, and it worked, and I could sense the other people around me trying to be more generous to me, and suddenly everybody was getting along much better. I think that was an important lesson right up there with wash the big dishes first. And then finally, I'm going to skip this, some of the things in here, because I'm getting bored myself. There was one woman there, Diane Girard, who is a very little English woman, as cute as a button. She'd been ordained several years ago, and she'd been director of Tassajara. It's hard to imagine because you couldn't hear her. She'd hardly talked, and when she did, she talked in a little English accent. But he had a sense that this was one strong person. And I guess she'd been the last 4 years as the head of San Francisco Zen bookstore. And then at Tassajara this summer, she was head of the shop there. And she gave a Dharma talk, which I thought was the most interesting and most amusing talk of the summer. And we had Reb gave a talk, and all the abbots gave talks, and Greg Fain gave talks. But Diane Girard only gave one talk, and right now she's back in England in a 9-month silent retreat. She doesn't really like talking. That night she said, you know, I'm going to arrange my talk this way. I'm saying goodbye to the bookstores, and over the last 4 years I've gotten used to being around book titles, and I'm going to give a talk about 4 book titles. I'm not going to talk about what the book's about. I'm just going to talk about the titles, because that's what I do. And I realized, that's what I do. You know, I don't really read all these thousands of books I own. I just stack them on the shelves and feel good because they're there. And so she gave a talk, and it was really very entertaining, about 4 book titles. And that's the way I would like to organize the rest of this talk. There is no rest of this talk, is there? Actually, I'm going to skip. I brought 4 books. And I always thought if I had a black bag like this, I would be definitely on the road to priesthood. And if you wrap up your books,
which is very priesthood, yeah.
Thank you. I'll give you the titles of these books, okay? So that you can see I'm a serious person. Actually, this is pretty shallow, isn't it? But here's the Zen Essence, The Science of Freedom, translated and edited by Thomas Cleary, which is kind of a they definitely arose together, this Essence of Zen. Zen Essence of Zen. And this is by Harada in Japan, and Diane, some of the people at Tassajara, one of them is there now at his monastery, and another one was ordained by him. And this is translated by Daigaku, who's a very severe-looking calligraphy teacher, Zen priest, tall, thin, stern, no nonsense. Who I was invited, because he was there at Tassajara. He actually signed this book. It says, "For Steve, everyday mind is the way." Gassho. But I asked him a question: do bees really have Buddha nature? And he said, "No. That you have to have consciousness to have Buddha nature. You have to have delusion to have Buddha nature. Or Buddha to be enlightened. To be enlightened, you have to experience the delusion." And then I went to talk to my tensei, the kitchen guy, Graham, who I was beginning to appreciate as a master in a way. And I said, you know, Daigaku says bees don't have Buddha nature and aren't enlightened, even though it seemed to me that they lived an enlightened life. And Graham says Buddhas have only Buddha nature. They have no delusion.
You mean bees?
Bees. Did I say Buddhists? Buddhists. Bees. Yeah. Bees are pure enlightenment. And that's probably why they make honey. Anyway. Another book. I was going to talk about each of these in just tiny little bit of depth, but I don't think I have time. Do I? There's one here. Just, this is The World is Made of Stories. And it's by David Loy, who's a Buddhist intellectual that's written books like Duality or Non-Duality, big, thick books. But this is his thin book. And it comes from a quote from Gary Snyder that I've cleverly... Maybe not so cleverly... So it comes from a quote from Gary Snyder. Damn it. The world is made of stories. Good stories are hard to come by. And a good story you can honestly call your own is an incredible gift. These stories are part of a bigger story that connects us all. And that's where the World of Stories title came from. And this is a fascinating book because it's mostly quotes of people from down through the ages talking about stories and how important they are, from the Christian story to the Buddhist story. So that's an important book that I was going to talk about, but I don't think I will. And then there's this other book, which I think is incredibly important for high school English teachers, How to Talk About Books You Haven't Read. And it's by this French intellectual, Pierre Bayard. And it took a French guy, a French intellectual, to really make convincing arguments that it was better, really, not to read books if you're going to talk about them. Because, you know, reading them limits you so. And if you just can kind of... First he complexified the whole thing. There are all these different ways that you can not read a book. You can have read it and just totally forgotten it, which I do a lot, but I remember the titles usually. Or you can kind of skim it, or you can read about it. It's hard really not to read a book if it's around. You know, you're going to get some sense of it. And he points out that there was an African tribe that talked to the Shakespearean scholar and just argued the hell out of her about Hamlet. They'd never heard of Hamlet. They'd never read it. But you can have strong opinions if somebody tells you a little bit about a Shakespearean play. And say, you know, there's these people walking in from the dead, the ghost father. And they said, ghosts do not walk. The dead do not walk. And they were adamant. And it's true. And she had no... She said, well, where I come from, ghost walk. And she said, and that kind of undermined her credibility right away. But then, finally, more in keeping with the theme of today's talk, I wanted to look at just this book, The Runaway Bunny, by Margaret Wise Brown. And I'll hold it, I'll show you the pictures, you know, like... She, Margaret Wise Brown, who wrote Goodnight Moon, children's classic, she only wrote books that she saw complete in dreams. So she got her books, all the books she wrote, well, there were three at least, The Runaway Bunny and Goodnight Moon, were two of the ones that... Continue. And so my wife gave me this book, and inscribed in the middle, or in the beginning, is the question, what are you going to do? Run away? See how symmetrical this talk is? That's what Mike asked me once. And once there was a little bunny who wanted to run away, it begins. So he said to his mother, "I am running away." "If you run away," said his mother, "I will run after you, for you are my little bunny." "If you run after me," said the little bunny, "I will become a fish in a trout stream, and I will swim away from you." "If you become a fish in a trout stream," said the mother, "I will become a fisherman, and I will fish for you." Very Tassajara. Mm-hmm. And then, "If you become a fisherman," said the little bunny, "I will become a rock on the mountain high above you." "If you become a rock on the mountain high above me," said his mother, "I will be a mountain climber, and I will climb to where you are." "If you become a mountain climber," said the little bunny, "I will be a crocus in a hidden garden." "If you become a crocus in a hidden garden," said his mother, "I will be a gardener, and I will find you." And she did the paintings also. And it goes on like that. There's no escaping your mother. "If you become a tree," said the little bunny, "I will become a little sailboat, and I will sail away from you." "If you become a sailboat and sail away from me," said his mother, "I will become the wind and blow you where you want to go." And it goes on like that. He joins the circus. She becomes trapeze artist. And so forth. And they wind up together that he realizes that escape is useless. Trying to escape is useless. And how does it end? "Shucks," said the bunny. "I might as well, just as well, stay where I am and be your little bunny." And she says, and so he did. "Have a carrot," said the mother bunny. You didn't think this was well planned, did you? "Have a carrot." So I decided not to stay at Tassajara, even though they were going to let me, even though I hadn't done a practice period anywhere else. I decided to come home to be a little bunny. Actually, my Dharma name is Bunkai, which is as close as the Japanese get to little bunny, I think, right?